This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, April 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Joe Biden won the presidency in large part by calling for unity. After 4 years of Trump's divisiveness, he said, the country needed to come together, recalling a sense of common purpose and decency. But over the last 2 years, disputes about the legitimacy of the election results, mask mandates, and critical race theory have shown the country to be as divided as ever. In a few weeks, primary elections for the midterm races will be really underway. The electoral map is stacked against the Democrats. Biden's approval ratings have sunk to the lowest level yet. His signature Build Back Better plan remains unpassed, and he faces ceaseless vitriol from congressional Republicans and their most vocal supporters. At a speech to House Democrats in Philadelphia last month, Biden outlined the stark political reality.
I thought we had to unify the country, because ultimately we are a democracy. And there needs to be, for it to work, there has to be consensus. The consensus, you got to get a majority. We've not been able to do that for a lot of the important things. That's why we have to continue to maintain our majority. This off-year election, in my view, may be the most important off-year election in modern history, because we know what happens. We know the fundamental change that shifts if we lose the House and Senate. The only thing I'll have then is a veto pen.
The Democratic Party needs a new roadmap to encourage accord among its factions and to expand its voter base. Across the country, a new generation of progressive activists and politicians are attempting to do both. In 2020, at age 28, a community organizer, Chloe Maxman, became the youngest woman ever elected to the Maine State Senate, representing a traditionally conservative rural district. She is the author, with her former campaign manager, Kenyon Woodward, of the forthcoming book, Dirt Road Revival. After showing how the Democratic Party lost the support of rural voters, they explain what it can do to reclaim their loyalty. Chloe and Kenyon join me now, and thank you both for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having us, Dorothy.
Sure. Thank you so much, Dorothy. It's such an honor and a privilege to be talking with you today.
You are both from rural areas where Democrats have found it really hard to win elections. And I thought you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your backgrounds and how you came to work together, maybe starting with you, Chloe.
Sure. I grew up in a small town in Maine called Nobleboro, a town of about 1,600 people on my family's farm. And I've always just really loved where I'm from. I love the land and the lakes and the rivers. I also love my community. You know, it wasn't until I ran for office and I got access to the voter database that I realized that almost everyone who raised me, who was a big part of my life, was a registered Republican. But growing up, we didn't really talk about politics. We talked about our values. Are you a good person? Are you a kind person? Do you show up when someone needs you? I went to Harvard for college, and it was definitely a bit of a culture shock. And it was there that I met Kenyon, and we became friends for so many reasons. One of them was that we were both from rural communities. We ended up co-coordinating the Divest Harvard movement together, trying to get Harvard to stop investing in fossil fuels. And we found ourselves doing sit-ins outside our president's office building, you know, really talking about how important progressive movements are, but also realizing how we couldn't really bring it back to our hometowns, that there was something in us that knew it wouldn't resonate and it wouldn't land well, even though the work was so important. And it started this lifelong conversation that we're still having about how can we organize with progressive values in rural conservative areas.
And one of the things, Kenyon, that struck me in the book is that you and Chloe immediately connected. Even though she's from the North, you're from the South, and often there's this thought that we still are, in effect, two separate countries. But in fact, the values that Chloe talks about are exactly the values you grew up with in rural North Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it felt like birds of a feather pretty quickly. One of our earliest memories together is trying to go and get supplies to make a anti-Keystone XL pipeline display on campus, and we had to ride a public bus, and neither of us had ridden a bus before and didn't realize you had to push the button to signal a stop. So we went whizzing past our stop and had no idea what was going on. So we just found some comfort in the shared navigation of a new environment. And, you know, the divestment organizing is what gave us all of the skills of grassroots organizing that we eventually took back to connect with the places that raised us.
So jumping ahead, you chronicle what you see as the major missteps of the Democratic Party. Many Democrats have acknowledged that they're too focused on fundraising from big donors, they're too intent on urban voters and on national rather than state and local politics. What do you think makes your assessment different from what we've been hearing for so many years?
I think everything that you just said are patterns that we have identified in our work in the Democratic campaign sphere. We've both worked on Democratic campaigns. And I think there's another one as well that we really notice, which is that the Democrats haven't really invested in or focused on long-term grassroots organizing, especially in rural places. We used to have infrastructures that tried to get there, like Obama's campaign, Obama for America, which had pretty broad reach. But those infrastructures have all but disappeared, and all those connections have been lost. And so what we're doing is really focusing on fundraising so we can really squeeze as much turnout as we can out of the people who are already connected to us. And we're just hoping that that's enough votes to win these incredibly important elections. What we're saying is that maybe there is a different way to think about this that is actually expanding our movement and going to talk with people who we've never talked to before.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I think One thing that's under talked about is, yes, Democrats haven't been doing a great job of organizing and speaking to values, but they've also just totally ceded the ground. You know, it wasn't long ago, like as recently as 2009, rural voters were evenly divided in their partisan leadings. Neither party had a material advantage in rural America, even though Democratic presidential candidates tended to underperform, but they totally abandoned grassroots organizing in these spaces. And that was reflected at the highest levels of party leadership when, you know, folks like DNC chair Tom Perez said that you can't door knock in rural America. And Chuck Schumer said that, you know, for every blue collar vote we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we'll pick up two in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And largely, Democratic leaders were nowhere to be seen in rural America. We weren't listening. We weren't cultivating relationships of trust. We were not telling a story that spoke to the sharp pain and struggles of the rural working class. And so that just created a huge void. And into that newly uncontested battlefield rushed right-wing activist groups, media personalities, and that's what led to the rise of Donald Trump and the capture of state legislatures that we're experiencing today.
And this is such a head-scratcher to me anyway. Democrats, of course, want to win in rural areas, but candidates just keep reinforcing their images as elitists and are just openly patronizing toward people who don't live on one of the two coasts. Why aren't Democrats doing the obvious thing, especially given what they presumably learned after the election of Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a head scratcher for us as well. Why do we keep reinforcing these patterns and strategies that are so detrimental to the Democratic Party? And, you know, for better or for worse, we need this party to fight for racial justice, to address the climate crisis. There's so much at stake right now. I think there's two things in my mind that really stand out. One, like we were talking about before, is we're not really focused on movement building. So it's become an echo chamber. And that echo chamber is really just reflecting the same stories over and over again. And people aren't seeing themselves reflected in those stories. So why why would they vote for the Democrats if they don't think that the Democrats understand their reality? You know, I remember canvassing back in 2018, a voter was telling me how they were really undecided between Trump and Clinton. But they went and listened to each of the speeches at the national conventions, and they heard Trump talking about rural folks and working class folks, and they didn't hear Clinton mention those words, and so they voted for Trump. So we have this problem that's really not integrating the voices of people outside of this very limited sphere. So because of that, we're not getting input, we're using the same strategies, and it's just it's taken us down a very bad road.
Yeah, I think all of that is exactly right. And another reason that we're not doing this is that the folks who call the shots on where we focus and where resources get allocated tend to be the top of the ticket campaigns and the party leadership. And when you're just trying to win a statewide electoral college vote, then for them, they have this political calculus of, well, why don't we just go into the Democratic strongholds, you know, the cities, and squeeze every single vote we possibly can out of them, which, you know, can work if all you care about is the statewide vote. But then you're left with situations like my home state of North Carolina, where you elect a Democratic governor statewide, but then you have majorities and super majorities in the state legislature. You're sending overwhelmingly Republican delegations to Congress because Republicans are just wiping the table with us everywhere else.
So maybe I'll ask you, Chloe, you won your race for the Maine House of Representatives in 2018, flipping a red district. You know, that was remarkable. And then a couple of years later, you ran for the state Senate and won. And maybe both of you, in fact, could just tell us how you did it.
Yeah, people ask us a lot how we won our races. And there's a lot that we did. You know, we really threw out the Democratic playbook. We didn't use any of the resources that the state party was handing down or any of their consultants. We decided to do it all ourselves and really figure out a different way for Democrats to win in rural America. Or can we even win in these really tricky districts? But the heart of what we did was we just talked to people. In the past two cycles, I've knocked on over 20,000 doors myself, and our campaigns in total have made over 100,000 voter contacts, you know, in these small state legislative districts in Maine. And through that, we have been talking mostly with Republicans and independents. And we've heard their stories. We've heard how they feel left out. We heard what they think about the Democrats. But we also heard what they care about, which is being able to afford to stay in our homes, to age with dignity, to have affordable health care. They care about the same things that we care about. Just sometimes we use a different language to talk about it. And so it was through that act of listening and respecting what we heard that we ended up finding so much common ground and being able to build these coalitions in these unlikely districts that led for a Democrat to win.
Yeah, totally. I think cycle after cycle, campaigns are handed the same establishment consultants by the party leadership that just create the same looking candidates, the same looking message. And so one of our goals was really to stand out and be different and be true to ourselves. And so we leaned into that in a lot of ways. And one was these homemade signs where we'd gather old campaign signs and have volunteer parties where we'd paint over them and just create really, really creative signs for Chloe that sprung up all over the district. And I think they really stood out to people as an embodiment of the grassroots nature of what we were doing.
We also really tried to use our campaign not just as a tool to get me elected, but as a public service for our community. when COVID hit in March 2020, we were in the height of our state Senate campaign going up against the highest ranking Republican in the state. But we put everything on pause and we pivoted our hundreds of volunteers towards calling seniors. And we called over 13,500 seniors in the district of all political persuasions. And we offered food, rides, prescription pickups, everything that you could think of. And we created this incredible mutual aid network through a campaign. And so I think folks saw that politics can be more than the extractive, negative, kind of toxic thing that invades our life every 2 years. It can be a really positive community service that gives us an opportunity about how to work better together.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Kenyon, you point out that Maine has smaller legislative districts than other states, and it has a public financing system called Clean Elections, which makes running for office possible for people who otherwise couldn't do it. Do you think that your grassroots strategies are broadly replicable across the country?
Yeah, they absolutely are. And I think of Beto in Texas and Stacey Abrams in Georgia are key examples of that, where it's all about people-powered campaigns and building these huge communities of volunteers that feel excited and motivated to go out into their communities and do this. And not all canvassing is created equal. You know, I think oftentimes when we've seen, you know, the party establishment come out into rural areas, it's with clipboard wielding, very generically trained folks who are kind of whacking people over the head with policy and reading a script that doesn't resonate. And so it's not all created equal, but it is really all about having strong grassroots people-powered campaigns. I like to say that things move at the speed of relationship in rural America. That's just like an essential part of life and our culture. And it's got to be an essential part of our organizing if we're going to succeed.
Democrats of all kinds appear to agree that the party is in need of some very serious soul-searching. Biden, who entered office effectively promising another New Deal, has been thwarted as much by one member of his own party, Joe Manchin, as by Republicans. And, you know, Democrats are always a fractious bunch, but this has been particularly notable. And I wondered, Kenyon, is there any way that Biden could have avoided this?
I mean, it's a tough situation to be in, right? I think looking big picture, we need to rethink the candidates that we put forward. I think there's a strong thread in the Democratic Party of thinking that if you can win in rural America, you have to be a Joe Manchin type candidate to do that. And I think one of the things that is so inspiring about Chloe is that she was not that. She in 2018 she was 25 years old running in the oldest county in Maine by age, and was not some, you know, mushy middle of the road Democrat. She was a pretty left-leaning climate activist in a district that had a 16-point Republican advantage, but folks voted for her. She appealed to folks. And so I think it's really important to push back on the belief that to win in rural states, you have to be a conservative Democrat. And I think that's our best way forward out of that predicament.
And Chloe, this gets to what you both say in the book, is you should sort of differentiate between labels and ideas and tell people how you approached climate change in a red state and made voters want to listen to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever I showed up at someone's door, I always considered it a pretty intimate thing. You know, you're on someone's property. You might be sitting at their kitchen table or standing on their porch. So I don't show up and say, "Hey, I'm Chloe. I'm running for state senate. This is who I am and what I believe in. Do you believe in it too?" The conversation always goes, "Hi, I'm Chloe. I'm running for state senate. What's on your mind? I'd really love to hear what you're thinking about these days." I just heard so much, you know, I just heard so much about how people are thinking about the world these days. I was pretty surprised to find that not many people mentioned climate change in this group of Republicans and independents that I've been talking to for the past couple cycles. But what I did hear was people talk all the time about how we want good jobs in rural America. We want sustainable industries. We want our small businesses to grow. We want to be able to go ice fishing in the winter. We want there to be enough rain for our farms in the summer. And to me, I mean, those are all ways that I think about climate change as well, you know, an economic opportunity to bring sustainable, you know, sustainable economically and sustainable environmentally work to rural places that are really desperate for it, and also to retain the culture and the practices of rural America. So, you know, that's really how I heard people talk about it. And I just thought that was so interesting and also kind of shed a light on how the left's messaging about climate change hasn't really resonated in rural towns. So when folks go to vote, you know, they're not really voting for whoever's talking about climate change per se. They're talking about who is going to best reflect the values and identity of rural Americans. That's usually Republicans, which is why, you know, especially at the state level, we're not seeing enough progress on climate. So in my service as a legislator, I've really tried to translate that way of talking about climate change into my policy and just really make sure it's rooted in rural working spaces.
I have to ask you, maybe Kenyon, you could answer this. Money is such a crucial part of, especially of national campaigns. Isn't it going to remain essential to effective political organizing, especially at the national level? And doesn't that require continued collaboration with big donors?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's totally right. And we need to keep pushing for reforms to get money out of politics. But in the meantime, the unfortunate reality is it is a huge factor. And I think one of the most important things that we need to do is convince those folks to not focus just on the presidency, just on the U.S. Senate, but to invest resources also in down ballot races and candidates that can go into rural communities from the, you know, from even the school board and local level on up and create authentic relationships with rural voters. I think that's really one of the key bridges to the national party having success. And right now we're just really not investing in reaching out to rural America at all. And a huge part of that is the donors that make those calls.
One of Obama's big mistakes after his initial campaign for the president was failing to keep all of those supporters whom he'd brilliantly corralled when he became president. He didn't keep them with him throughout his presidency. He just sort of let them fade away. He got too preoccupied, understandably, with all the big issues he had to deal with. But you have to keep people excited, as you point out, about politics after the excitement of a close race. How do you do that?
The first thing that comes to mind for me is really investing in your volunteers when you build your campaign and being deliberate about training them in the skills of grassroots organizing. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of that came out of our campaigns is volunteers independently started up local grassroots groups as direct spin-offs from our campaign. And one of those groups was who we turned to when COVID hit to pilot the mutual aid effort that we ran. And that just reflects the need to not just give people a quick generic training and a clipboard with a script on it and say, see you later, can you make it back for another shift next week? But to actually take the time to invest in folks and invest in their growth and development as organizers and make them feel part of a strong community.
So here's a final question, and it's a tough one. We are seeing, possibly, a disaster in this year's elections for the Democrats. The polling just looks abysmal. That could change, of course, over the coming months. But what would you advise Democrats running in contested districts this election cycle to emphasize over the next few months?
I think, you know, it sounds so basic, but it's the most human and humane thing we can do is just go talk to people, go have an honest conversation about why we're failing, why people don't believe in us, and see if there's any space to repair that relationship. It's simple in theory. You know, putting it into practice can be tricky because in an urban space, you can knock 200 doors a day and it's easy. And in our district, you know, it takes over an hour to drive from end to end. And it's, you know, 100 doors a day is about what someone can manage. So it requires more time. It requires more investment, more volunteers, more resources. But we just can't take the easy way out. We've been doing that for too long and we are paying incredibly dire consequences. So we just gotta go talk to folks and make sure that what we hear is being reflected in how we campaign, how we message, how we serve in office.
I think what Chloe said is totally right. We, you know, for for whatever reason, we keep on pumping millions and millions of dollars into television ads instead of direct organizing where we can meet people face to face and actually move them through conversation. And then I think the other big thing is leaving the policy books aside, or at least giving them a lighter touch, and being intentional about telling personal stories that reflect common values. I think that's one of the areas where we've really struggled to connect. And rural folks vote on what rings true and personal to them. So we need to be authentic and not just going off of, you know, poll-tested, politically triangulated messaging. Because folks see through that and it turns them off. We just started a nonprofit called Dirt Road Organizing, and our goal is to basically bring our experience and what we've learned in these campaigns to other rural communities and train folks in grassroots organizing and seeking out these common values and creating bridges in rural communities so that we can move forward gracefully into what's sure to be a challenging decade ahead of us.
Thanks so much to both of you. I really appreciate you coming on, and I do feel more hopeful now.
Thank you so much, Dorothy. It was so great chatting with you.
Thank you so much. We're so grateful to have this opportunity.
Chloe Maxman serves District 13 of the Maine State Senate. Kenyon Woodward was the campaign manager for Maxman's 2018 and 2020 campaigns. Their book, Dirt Road Revival, will be published on May 10th. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.